Well, now I think as we come to the word this morning, if I were to take a poll among the brethren here, if I were to count each of you with a specific question, I think I would find not a few, especially among the men, who would rather watch a documentary on the invention and evolution of the paperclip than watch a love story. There would probably be a few of you who would fit into that category. But in fact, if you really stop and think, deep down inside, there's a romantic in every one of us, isn't there? And we love a good love story where the guy overcomes all odds to win her heart, and they together overcome great difficulties in order to be together. And though they struggle and have difficulties, in the end, it all works out and they live happily ever after. There's something in us that says, yeah, you know, I really do have a soft spot in my heart for those realities. Well, this morning, as we come to God's Word, I want us to look at a historical record of a brief account of rural life in Israel. And isn't it what day could be a better day to look at a biblical love story than Mother's Day? And not only is this a suitable story, a record, an historical record for Mother's Day because it's a love story, but because it's a story of a woman who longed for a son and got one. And I want us to look at the book of Ruth this morning, this beautiful tale of ordinary life set against the backdrop of ancient Israel in the time of the judges. And I want us to look at this story, the gospel, as I call it, according to Naomi. Now, there are many practical lessons that could be learned from the book of Ruth, especially with regard to male and female piety. As a matter of fact, in the Hebrew Bible, at least in some Hebrew Bibles, Ruth is put immediately after Proverbs 31. And she is painted as the example of the Proverbs 31 woman. We could learn about matters related to courtship and dating, or whichever word you want to use, and marriage. We could learn even some principles for well-ordered society from looking at how these brethren lived their lives. But Ruth stands at a very strategic place in our English Bibles, for Ruth stands between Judges in 1 Samuel. And that's not just a nice place to fit a little four-chapter book, but it stands between the story of the decay that takes place in Judges and the brightening hope that eventually comes with David. And Ruth stands in the middle as the chain that holds them together. Now, I'm not going to take time to read the book of Ruth. I would encourage you at some point to do that. At different points, I will refer to verses within the book, and I'll make my way through this entire book this morning. As we come to this book this morning, at four chapters, and I have four headings. The first, chapter one, the problems of life. The problems of life. On a macro scale, Ruth presents to us a time with very great national difficulties. Look with me at verse 1. Now it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land. Now that puts us right back into the book that immediately precedes this book in our Bibles. And if we want a summary of what's taking place, we only have to look a page back at the end of Judges chapter 21 and verse 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. It was a time of social disorder. There was no king in Israel. It was a time of moral decay. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. There was famine in the land, as we read there in verse 1. Famine is one of the things that God threatened His people with if they were to apostatize from following after Him. Now, if you've ever read the book of Judges, I know you have in your public reading, no doubt. You come to those last few chapters, and there's some of us that just want to skip those when we're reading them with our children, because there's some pretty gruesome and some pretty disgusting things that take place. The sins that are highlighted in the last few chapters of the book of Judges. And those pictures, those chapters actually probably give an overarching picture of what the whole time of Judges was moving toward and what it was like in the moral decay that was going on in society. And God had said that when His people turned away from following after Him, one of the judgments He would bring would be famine. Well, it's very possible that that's exactly what they were experiencing here, was a judgment from God upon them for their apostasy. That's the national scale. But on a micro scale, on a personal level, we also come to the book of Ruth. And as we start the book off, there's weeping and bitterness, emptiness and affliction on all sides. Look with me at verse 9. May the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband. Then she, Naomi, kissed them, Orpah and Ruth, and they lifted up their voices and wept. We read the same words again in verse 14. And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Naomi is an old woman. She is separated from her homeland, living in Moab. She is a widow. She has been a widow for at least 10 years. Both of her sons, her only sons, have died. She is left with two foreign daughter-in-laws living in a foreign land with no grandchildren. And now we read in those two verses that we just read that she is kissing her daughter-in-laws. The kissing there is the kissing of parting. She is parting with the only human family she has near to her. She is in a time of great personal difficulty and great personal struggle. The Lord now comes and, the Lord has come and worked in her life in a way that she describes as bitterness. Notice with me verse 20. She said to them, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara. For the Lord God Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me." And the word Mara means bitter. "I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has inflicted me?" She has no prospect of resolving any of these problems. She will not have children so that her daughter-in-laws can have husbands, so that her daughter-in-laws can have children. She has no possibility. Now she is separating from them. Her husband's dead. Her family is dead. She is a very bitter woman. And I say bitter not in the sense that her spirit itself is bitter, but the circumstances that she is suffering from are very bitter circumstances. She struggles with very challenging times. But now, we can't stop there, because there is a sense in which even at the micro level, even in the midst of the weeping and bitterness, even in the midst of the emptiness and the affliction on every side, she acknowledges that God is here in the midst of this. As she sends her daughter-in-laws back, she prays for them. Notice how she prays for them. Again, verse 9. "May Jehovah, Yahweh, the Lord, grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of a husband." Then she kissed them. She said in the previous verse, "May Yahweh deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me." The word "deal kindly" is that word chesed in the Hebrew. May He show covenant, loyal faithfulness to you. She says it again later when she parts from them in verses 13 and 14. She wants God to bless them. So she's still praying to Jehovah. And I'm going to go back and forth because I've got this stuck in my head. The word Lord in our Bibles, L-O-R-D, lowercase caps, small caps, is the Hebrew, translates the Hebrew word, often translated Jehovah or Yahweh. And I'm just in the matter of getting this into my mind where I say Yahweh more so that I can think of this covenant name. So if I go back and forth, you'll know why I'm in the process of wrestling with that myself. But it's an incredible name that speaks of God's covenant dealings with His people. And this is the one to whom she prays. And she prays to Him to pass on or to express His covenant mercies, His loving kindness to these two girls. She acknowledges that Yahweh's hand is behind all of her troubles. Notice verse 13. Would you therefore wait until they are grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you. For the hand of Yahweh has gone forth against me. And again in verses 20 and 21. When she's describing in that sowing circle there in Bethlehem, not to call her Mara. Why? Because the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but Yahweh has brought me back empty. God's hand is behind all of these difficulties that she is facing on a personal level. These are the problems of life. Sounds very much like what many of us face in this world today, doesn't it? Is not the world filled with decay and disorder? Is there not chaos on every side with the internet and the other media that we have access to? We've got things going on all over the world that we're made immediately aware of in terms of the social disorder that's going on. And yet then also the moral decay that's all around us. And then there are those of us in our personal lives who are wrestling with the bitterness of heart for what God has brought into our personal lives, the struggles of physical afflictions, the struggles of family difficulties, the struggles of financial difficulties. On a personal level as well as on a national and international level, these problems really do face us all, just like they did Naomi. But we also must see that there are glimpses of hope here. There's some incredible glimpses of hope. Remember verses 16 and 17. Many of you are probably familiar with these words that Ruth speaks to her mother-in-law. When her mother-in-law tries to get them to go back, Ruth said in chapter 1:16, "Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may Yahweh do to me and worse, if anything but death put parts you and me." Here's a glimpse of hope, a partial answer to the loneliness that Naomi is wrestling with. Here is a daughter-in-law who will not leave her. There's also another glimpse of hope in potential provision. For we read it is at the time of the end of the barley harvest in verse 22. Naomi returned, and with her Ruth and the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, and returned from the land of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. The Lord had met and blessed Israel with food. So there's the potential for provision. Remember, she's a widow. She has no way to provide for herself. She has no family, no sons to provide. Here then is a glimpse of hope. And then at the very beginning of chapter 2, we're given a little glimpse of another picture of hope. Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, and of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Now, My family really doesn't like it when I watch movies with them because I do things that annoy them. Things like when there's a little glimpse of somebody that appears on the screen and then they pass off. Aha! She did it! He's the one! Keep your eye on him! Well, that's what the writer's doing for us here. Right? We come to chapter 2 and verse 1. He says, oh, flash, Boaz, kinsman, wealthy, aha! I'm supposed to remember him. Because he then becomes a central figure as we move into chapter 2. So chapter 1, the problems of life. But we must not stop there, nor must we, in the midst of our struggles, stop there. We need to move into chapter 2 where we see the gleanings of kindness. The gleanings of kindness. Now, in this chapter, it becomes very clear, if you read through the chapter, that there is one note that is going to be hit over and over and over again, and it's this word, glean. Notice with me, chapter 2, verse 2. Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one of those after one in whose sight I may find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. Verse 3. So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. Verse 7. And she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers. Verse 8. Boaz said to Ruth, listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field. And we could look at verse 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and 23 and see this word over and over again. Because the writer wants us to think there's gleanings here. There's something to take up. It's not necessarily at this point the full harvest. It's just gleanings. But these are gleanings of kindness. For we see, after we see this word gleanings coming out, we see the kindness of Boaz. Notice how kind Boaz shows himself to be as he comes on the scene. We read in verse 8 and verse 9a of how he offers sustained provision for Ruth and her mother-in-law. Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. Here is a place where you can find provision for your daily needs and for Naomi's daily needs. At the end of verse 9, we read that he also promises protection. For we read there, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. And so there's protection for this single young woman who's walking around. She needs protection. He says, you will be protected here. At the end of verse 9, he talks about the provision of water. Now, in that culture, if you know anything about the environment there in the Middle East, and in particular in Israel, water is at a premium. And so he says to her, when you come out here to glean, since you don't have your Nalgene bottle with you, come over and drink from the bucket. And where my servants drink, you shall have water. He provides water for her. And then in verses 11 and 12, we see his kindness in commending her character and her faith. Boaz replied to her, all that you have done for the mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know. May Yahweh reward your work and your wages be full from Yahweh, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. He commends her for her character. You've been taking care of your mother-in-law. It's been reported to me. It's known to all. And he commends her faith. Notice how he says what she's doing. You have come to seek refuge under the wings of Yahweh. She's not just happened to come into a community where there happens to be a soup kitchen. She has come into a community and she has devoted herself to following after Yahweh, following after the God of Naomi, the God of the Israelites. And that's what we see in those verses that I read earlier in verses 16 and 17 in chapter 1. This is more than just personal devotion. This is faith in God. She says, your God, my God. And then she takes an oath in the name of Yahweh. She says, thus may Yahweh do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts me. She makes herself accountable to Yahweh to care for her mother-in-law. This woman is a woman of faith, and she expresses that faith here, and Boaz, in kindness, gives her a commendation for her faith. And we read in verse 14 how he goes on providing abundance of food for her and Naomi, an abundant, gracious response to her physical needs in verses 15 and 16, to the point where we read in verse 18 that she ate to the point of being satisfied and still had something left over to take home. This is kind of ancient Israel's version of American kitchens. You know, how many of us got up this morning and the first thing on our lips was said, "Lord, give me this day my daily bread." And then we thought to ourselves, "Where is that going to be? Oh, what do I have to do to go out and find something to eat?" I know, I'll go to the kitchen. Cupboard after cupboard after cupboard, refrigerator, pantry, food everywhere. There's abundance to be had. And that's the picture here. There's an abundance to be provided for. She has enough to feed herself, to care for herself, and go home and pass it on to Naomi. And then I want you to note, in terms of the, we're still looking at the kindness of Boaz, I want you to note Ruth's response. Note with me verse 10, and we see her response to this kindness that has been shown to her. Then she fell on her face. Not a very becoming position, but one clearly of respect. Bowing to the ground, again an expression of humility, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" What incredible humility Ruth expresses here. As this kindness comes to her, she doesn't say, "It's about time somebody noticed what I've been sacrificing all these years." That's a typical American response. But it's, "Who am I that you would do this to me? I'm just a foreigner." And she took the posture of great humility before Boaz and his kindness. Now, before we pass from this gleanings of kindness that Boaz showers upon Ruth and Naomi, I want you to see how Naomi views this kindness that's been shown to her. Look at verse 20. "For Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, after getting a full report of where she had been during the day, she says to her, 'May he, Boaz, be blessed of Yahweh, who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and the dead.'" See what she says? I see in Boaz Yahweh's kindness. The source of this kindness is not just this wealthy neighbor, this wealthy relative. It is Yahweh using him and remembering me and my family. Again, Naomi said to her, "The man is our relative. He is one of the closest relatives." Now, if you have the New King James, I believe it may actually put the word redeemer in there. I know that if you have the Spanish Bible, it's got a word which emphasizes redeemer. The Hebrew word is goel, a close relative, one who is to redeem on behalf of another member of the family. You see, Naomi sees not only Yahweh's kindness for now, she's already got her mind going and sees Yahweh's provision for the future. She sees a husband. Now, this is not Yenta-like behavior. This is faith, as we'll see in a little bit. She believes that she is seeing God providing for their greatest needs. Not just the provision for daily activity, but something beyond that. Someone who is a redeemer to meet their greatest needs. And she sees that the benefit of this kindness is going to go on and spread. For she says, Naomi said to Ruth, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maids." She says, this is the right thing. God is doing good to us, gleanings of kindness, and she sees Yahweh behind it all. Now, again, I just want to stop briefly and make a few brief applications here. For again, in the midst of the problems of life that you and I face, do we see the gleanings of kindness that are all around us? That we are constantly receiving and constantly picking up loyal friendships. People, husbands, wives, family members, friends within the church who are there when we need them. Who are there to uphold us, strengthen us, encourage us, rebuke us. Faithful, loyal friends. That's a gleaning in this life of God's kindness to us. Daily provisions, as I said, abundantly provided. Not many of us worried about that when we got up. Maybe you had more than I did in terms of worrying about it because you were thinking about, well, there's not going to be anything in the bank to buy food this next week. But the fact of the matter is, when you stop and think about it, look at how much we have gleaned that God has given to us and given to us in abundance. How many times have we received as well those comforting words in the midst of the difficulties that we were going through, and somebody came along and said, you know, I just want to tell you what an inspiration you are to me. Inspiration. You, if you saw me last night and the way I was weeping, well, you know what? I see you clinging to God, and you go, wow, that's an encouragement. Or that card that comes, or now those emails that come, or electronic cards that come to express those comforting words. The protection that we have. Look at the news sometime of what's going on in Pakistan, Syria, Libya, and these other parts of the world. You say, you know what? We're not seeing soldiers run up and down our streets. The protection that we have on a regular basis. What an amazing love story this is. And the pictures that we can see of the gleanings of kindness even in the midst of the problems of life. That brings us then to chapter 3. Having looked at the problems of life and the gleanings of kindness, we come in the third place to the audacity and humility of faith. The audacity, or boldness if you prefer, and humility of faith. Or if you prefer, you can go more in terms of the activities, a bold proposal and a willing redeemer. Subtitle for chapter 3 is this: gleanings are good, but redemption is better. Gleanings are good, but redemption is better. No sooner has this taken place and the harvest has gone on, I should say no sooner. Verse 23 of chapter 2 indicates that at least approximately 7 weeks have passed, because this gleaning activity has taken them through 2 harvests, the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. Then Naomi, the mother-in-law, makes a plan for her daughter-in-law. And so what we see in verses 1 to 5 is the plan taking shape, or if you prefer, as I have it highlighted or identified, the audacious, the bold faith of Naomi. As I've said, Naomi sees more in Boaz than just somebody to help provide for their daily meals. She sees a husband for Ruth. On the basis of his integrity, his position as a kinsman redeemer, this close relation, the past kindnesses that he has shown to them, Naomi develops an audacious, a bold plan to direct Ruth to propose marriage to Boaz. Now, I call it audacious faith because what she proposes for Ruth to do is rooted in Scripture. You don't need to turn there, but I'll read the passages, but you may if you wish. But in Leviticus chapter 25 and verse 25, we read this: if a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold. It's very likely that that's what Elimelech has done here, is he had to sell his property when he went off to Moab because he was so poor and to provide for his family. And so now she has no inheritance. Well, without an inheritance, she has no place within Israel. So the land is very important for the carrying on of the name and having a place within the people of God. And she sees Boaz as that one who can come and buy back the property. He is that next of kin, that nearest kinsman who can buy it back. She also sees, I believe, from passage like Deuteronomy chapter 25, that Boaz has the potential to answer to the problem of a husband for Ruth and the need for an heir in the family. We read in Deuteronomy 25, when brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out from Israel. Now, there's a problem, because the passage talks about a brother coming and raising a name to a brother. This is not Elimelech's brother. Naomi is too old to have children. So Naomi, in her audacious faith, looks at this passage, at passages like this, and says, you know what? This applies to me. I can yet have an heir through Ruth if Boaz will take Ruth. And so she's got faith that looks at the Word of God and sees in it the principles to say, here's where the solution lies for our problems. And so taking God at her word, she forms this proposal that Ruth is to go to get herself all gussied up and nicely dressed and then clean herself up from having worked out in the fields all day, and then to go down to the threshing floor and meet Boaz. Then we come in verses 6 through 9 to the audacious and humble manifestation of the faith of Ruth. Or, if you will, the bold proposal. In verses 6 through 9 of chapter 3, we read of how Ruth fills out or enacts this plan that Naomi has given her. She says, we read, so she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. It happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. He said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative. In this passage, we read of Ruth's audacious yet humble manifestation of faith. Ruth goes to the threshing floor. This is a bold move, one, because this isn't where women were allowed, generally. Two, it was outside the city, where she would have to leave the protection of the city and go out to this place where men were. But at the same time, you see the humility of Ruth. For what is she doing? Like Esther, who listened to Mordecai, she is listening to Naomi. And under Naomi's direction, she enacts this plan. Boaz is found enjoying his dinner. I do not believe that this is drunkenness. I don't think the picture here is that of gluttony. The picture is that of a man who has worked hard, enjoying the labor of his hands. He is delighting in the provision of God. He then goes down and takes his place next to his grain and sleeps. Ruth, as you know, approaches and lays down at his feet. Now, I'll just make one brief comment. I know a lot of the commentators seek to draw parallels between covering and feet and some of the other words used here and try to put the picture together that something immoral took place. That Ruth was acting as a Moabitess woman, and she's now going up and as it were, trying to seduce him. Well, what we're supposed to at least see is that that is a potential that somebody might think is going on. That certainly is a potential that somebody might actually think that a woman, a prostitute, has come in and is trying to sneak up to this wealthy man and satisfy him. But that's not what's taking place here. Feet are feet. Whatever the picture might try to be, I think the feet are just feet. She goes up and lays herself down at his feet. She covers herself with his feet. She may actually uncover his legs in the sense of covering up so he's going to get cold. That may have been what actually woke him up. But nevertheless, she lays at his feet. So this is also very bold. For she is going in and lying down there among the men, thing that women don't generally do. But yet she does it in a very humble way. She does it at his feet. Somehow he is startled and he wakes up. And Ruth is more bold than she has been thus far. And when he wakes up, we miss it. The English, you know, when she says, "I am Ruth, your maid, so spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." Well, I'm kind of cold. If you'd cover me up, that'd be great, because you're a redeemer. No. "Will you marry me?" English idiom. Now, that's bold faith. Again, following from Naomi and following these scriptural principles that have guided them, "Will you marry me?" And not only that, she holds the scripture over his head. "You are a close kinsman. You're a redeemer. This is your job." But yet notice her humility even in that. "Your maid," she says twice. "Your maid." She does not go in as a brazen, brash individual. She goes in with chasteness and with humility and in faith and makes this proposal to Boaz. Well, Boaz is a willing redeemer. And so we see the tokens of encouragement to her faith. He acknowledges in verse 10 the wisdom of her choice. "May you be blessed of Yahweh, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich." You see what he says? He says to her, "You have done a very great kindness to me." He's obviously older than she is. "And yet you have not gone where your eyes would lead. You have not gone where social custom would lead you. You have shown me a kindness and come to me." If I could summarize it, it's this. He's saying this. Wise choice. Wise choice that you have made in coming and choosing me and not going where these other things would dictate. He, in essence, is pointing out the fact that she's living by faith and not by sight. Then notice how he encourages her, and there's this token of encouragement to her faith, for he says to her, "Do not fear." He seeks to comfort her fears. "My daughter," a term of endearment to this younger woman, "I will do for you whatever you ask." What a promise. "I will do for you whatever you ask, because your character is known to me." Verse 12, "Now it is true, I am a close relative. However, there is a closer one than I. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as Yahweh lives. Lie down until morning." So much comfort in the words that he speaks to her. Listen to the promises of redemption that he makes. "I will do for you whatever you ask. I am a redeemer. I will redeem you. I call God to witness." Strengthening her faith with these tokens of expression of determination to follow through. And then he encourages her to lie down, and then protecting her testimony when she gets up in the morning, he encourages her to leave, and then gives her more grain than she knows what to do with, and sends her away with encouragement. But I want you to note just a little picture here about how God works. God tells us we must live by faith. And so we must constantly be living a life of faith. And at times, don't we exercise our faith, and just when we think the answer is in our hands, then it's wait. What? Yes, wait. Ruth, I will do all that you ask. But wait, remain in a posture of faith, trusting my word, trusting my promises. There's somebody closer. Now, she knew Boaz. She knew what Boaz was capable of, his wealth and his kindness and his faith and his godliness. She knew all those things about him. But this other man, nobody knows anything about him. We still don't know who he was or why he did what he did, and he's never named. But that's just where God puts us many times, doesn't he? I will, but wait, in my way, in my time. And so she must continue to remain in a posture of faith, believing the promises that have been made to her. And then when she gets back, Naomi encourages her faith by saying, wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until he has settled it today. What faith Naomi has. This man is a godly man. He will follow through. She believes his promises. She believes the promises of the Redeemer. Well, the love story continues to unfold in chapter 4 then, having seen the problems of life, the gleanings of kindness, the audacity and humility of faith, we come in the fourth chapter, in the fourth point, redemption accomplished and applied. Redemption accomplished and applied. And I know, I'll tell you why I chose those words in a moment. They were chosen not just because they're the title of a great book, but they're chosen because they do say something about what's taking place here. In verses 1 to 10 of this chapter, many of you know the story, but let me just fill it in for those who may not and for the refreshing of all of our minds. We see redemption accomplished. Boaz fulfills his promise. Boaz is determined to fulfill his promise. He's made the promise and he goes straight to the gate. He calls together the legal team that he needs, all of the elders there at the gate. He sees the man that's the closer redeemer. He calls him over and sits down. He says, we've got something to talk about. He addresses him about redeeming Naomi's property. He says, okay, I'll buy the property. Great. Well, there's one thing. You also get Ruth, the Moabitess. And I wonder if he just emphasized that just a little bit. Because, you know, Moabites were not people that were well accepted. Matter of fact, there were laws against Moabites coming into the temple down to a certain number of generations. And so this was pretty amazing. So I kind of wonder sometimes, and maybe it's a little bit of imagination, but did he say it that way? But whatever the case, whether he meant where he said it and emphasized it or not, when this man hears that Ruth is part of the package, he backs out. Now, maybe it was legitimate. Maybe his own inheritance was at stake. And if he had children, he would lose that inheritance. There could have been legitimate reasons. Or it may have been entirely due to prejudice. I don't want a Moabite wife. Or it may have been due to the fact, oh, man, that's too much burden to take on. For whatever reason, he says no. And Boaz says, yes. That's exactly what I wanted to hear. And so Boaz, taking this very interesting custom, takes off his shoe, hands his sandal over to the man and says, I have purchased this woman. Notice what he says. Verse 7, now this is the custom in former times in Israel concerning the redemption of the exchange of land to confirm any matter. A man removed his sandal and gave it to another. And this was the manner of attestation in Israel. So the closest relative, the Redeemer, said to Boaz, buy it for yourself. And he removed his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Moreover, I have acquired Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance, so that the name of the deceased will not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are my witnesses. Boaz says, I not only fulfill my role as redeemer, I want everybody to know this is what a redeemer does. And that's who I am. I redeem the property and restore it. I redeem Ruth in order to raise up a name. The people hear this and they get all excited at his excitement. And you just see this. I like to think they maybe sang these next verses, though it only says they said them. All the people who were with in the court and the elders said, we are witnesses. May Yahweh make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. And may you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah through the offspring which the Yahweh will give you by his young women. They take all the covenantal language they can think of and say, she is no longer an alien. She is now part of the covenant people. She is now under the blessings that come with being part of covenant people of God. So all the blessings of the covenant people that came to Rachel and Leah as they had many children and many came and all of the tribes came and all of the land that is theirs and the wealth that is to come, may it all come to you, Boaz, and to Ruth. See what an amazing change has taken place. This person who once was not part of the people of God now is part of the people of God. This alien and stranger is now one of the household of God's people because of her union with the Redeemer. Boaz fulfills his promise, provides the redemption. The song of praise is sung. And then we read in verses 13 to 22, redemption applied. Redemption applied. Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife. And he went into her, and Yahweh enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. What an amazing, amazing reality. There's the answer in the form of a baby born into the world to meet the need. And this little one is then taken and given to Naomi. The women say to Naomi, verse 14, blessed is Yahweh, who has not left you without a redeemer today. And may his name become famous in Israel. That is the baby's name. May he also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. So Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, and became his nurse. And the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, a son has been born, notice, to Naomi. Her needs have been met through the promises of the Redeemer. So they named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Yahweh causes her to conceive. Yahweh provides redemption. That's why I call this the gospel according to Naomi. You see, here's Naomi's picture, and it's sung by these ladies. Redemption has come to you. You were dead in your body, dead in your circumstances, dead without any hope of changing it at all. But another came and provided the answer for your great needs. A redeemer came. Redemption has come in the form of a baby. But we have a little hint here, right at the end of the story, that the story's not just for Naomi and Ruth. For it immediately says, as I just read, he is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now, in the words of Paul Harvey, now you know the rest of the story, right? We know where this is going. Who is David? The great king of Israel. The one who is going to restore order to God's kingdom when there was chaos. The one who is going to bring the solutions and reestablish the law so that the people will live according to the purposes of God. Moral order will be restored. Redemption is coming to Israel through David, not just to Naomi. What a wonderful love story. What a wonderful picture for Mother's Day. But now if we were to go to Naomi on that day as she held Obed and said to her, Naomi, tell us the good news as you understand it. What is the good news for you, Naomi? She would say something like this. The good news is wrapped up in a person who is a redeemer. But before I tell you about the redeemer, let me tell you the context in which the redeemer comes. The redeemer came unto me when everything was out of order. Life was completely uncertain. I was totally in a society that was depraved. I myself was in difficulty. No possibility of solving any of my problems. On a personal level, there was nothing but grief and pain and emptiness and sorrow. And Paul would pick up on that theme and he would say, and that's not just the external circumstances that man deals with. The death that she had in her womb and the death to her hopes that she had for the future are pictures of the reality of what every man suffers because of sin and the pain that comes to each and every one of us. For Paul writes in Romans chapter 5, while we were still helpless at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for the good man someone would dare even to die. But God demonstrates His own love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. This is the picture of humanity. Isn't that the picture of what we look at our lives? We see the sin within. We see how it's destroying our own lives. Maybe you sit there this morning. And there's that guilty conscience in the back of you. Say, you know, I really shouldn't act that way. I really shouldn't be stealing from my employer. I really shouldn't be cheating on my taxes. I really shouldn't be cheating on my wife. I really shouldn't be dealing with my children in that kind of anger. I really shouldn't be expressing sin in this way with my tongue, in this way with my hands, in this way with my eyes, in this way with my heart and my thoughts. But where is there any hope? Because everybody around me is in the same problem. Look at the world. Look at Libya. Look at Syria. Okay, so they took out Osama bin Laden. But look at the rest of the world. There's no solution, no hope, no help. Where do I look? You see, you are what Paul described and what Naomi would say was her life without hope, being without God in the world. And yet, Naomi would go on to say, but you know, even in the midst of all that hopelessness, I kept seeing God give us these little gleanings of benefit all along the way. And I just kept seeing Him do these kind things to me. And some of you, that's where you are. You're enjoying the gleanings. And God is keeping you alive and giving you life and breath every single day of your life. And blessings and joys and happiness and abundance. Friends and food and family and provisions of all kinds. And you're sitting there sucking up the gleanings and you're satisfied. And that's where Naomi would say, but you know what? Gleanings are good. But redemption is better. But you see, there was something far more because I could see the end of the gleanings and they weren't satisfying the greatest needs that I had. There was no lasting hope to deal with the greatest of problems. I needed redemption. And redemption came in that person I mentioned earlier, the Redeemer. Somebody like unto me. Somebody who was a close relative to me. And the Scriptures in the New Testament pick up on that theme. We have a Redeemer who is like unto us, who took to Himself flesh and blood, who came into this world in the form of a man. We sang in one of the hymns that who could take on this punishment but God? Well, that's not the whole truth. It's the God-man alone who could take that on for us. And he became like unto us. In the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law. Like the children of flesh and blood, he himself partook of the same, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death. And where Boaz had to take on the entire redemption price for her and make redemption at every level for her, so too Jesus Christ has come into the world to take up the whole price of redemption for those whom he saves. The entire price is upon him. It's not based on you. It's nothing you can do. It's all in him. He is the only one who can provide, and he has provided through his own blood. The spotless Lamb has shed his precious blood. You read of it just a couple weeks ago, or just maybe even last week, 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 9. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, that you through his poverty might become rich. Redemption, full and free, accomplished and applied by the Redeemer on behalf of the needy. Now listen to me. You're hearing the story, and maybe you like the story of Ruth and Naomi, and it's a wonderful story, isn't it? Come on, guys. You like the paperclip story, too, but you like this kind of story, don't you? There's something about this that says, yeah, that's exciting, because there's the problems of life, and they're dealt with. Oh, young person, or my friend here who likes the story of Ruth and Naomi, there's a greater story of redemption. And you're the one in great need. You're the one who sits without hope and without possibility of changing your present circumstances. You're the one who is in need of a Redeemer. God has sent forth His Son into this world to die for sinners like you and like me. He has sent forth a Redeemer into this world that you might be saved. But you see, you need to respond like Ruth and Naomi. You need to take the Redeemer at His word and believe Him when He says, I will pay the price. And you must humble yourself and take the posture of humility and bowing face down before Him. And you see, that's the problem with many of you growing up in America today. Because you won't humble yourself. And I would just urge you, as I close this morning, I'd urge you, do not be paralyzed by all the pain of life. It didn't paralyze Naomi. It didn't paralyze Ruth. Don't be paralyzed by all the personal pain or the international pain. And don't be content with mere gleanings. You see, they all come from God. That's the other thing that Naomi would say. He brought the pain. He brought the gleanings. He brought the Redeemer. He gave me my Son. And the same is true for the salvation that God provides for you. He has brought the pain. He has brought the gleanings. He has provided the redemption through the Redeemer that you might look to Him and not to yourself. Look unto Christ, the greater than David, who came into this world sinners to save. Let's pray.